Hello and welcome to episode 78 of The Brand Lounge, where every Thursday we feature insightful brand stories to showcase the hundreds of ways that businesses are started, the ups and downs of being an entrepreneur, and to reassure you that you are not doing this thing alone. I'm Tammy Heels, your host and founder of Shadowcat Creative, where I'm a personal brand and marketing consultant. And today I am once again joined by Lynn Power, co-founder and CEO of her joint business, Mazami. Welcome back to the show, Lynn.
Thank you, Tammy. It's great to be back.
Oh, it's awesome to have you back here. If you missed the last episode, listeners, go back and have a little listen. Lynn and I talked about what it's really like to work with a business partner, and I was really surprised by some of the insights that we came up with about what makes a good business partner and kind of the balance between the two. So be sure to rack that one up on the playlist if you missed it. So Lynn, today we're talking all about you and your business journey. And I'm aware that you've run a couple of businesses in the past. So let's start with, what was it that inspired you to become a business owner?
You know, it's interesting because in my case, it was more about not wanting to do what I was doing versus running towards something. So I had been in advertising for 30 years. I was the CEO of J. Walter Thompson, New York. And what people often don't realize is that when you get to be the CEO, your job changes and it's not always very fun. You're dealing with a lot of the financial issues. You're dealing with HR issues. You're dealing with legal issues. We had a very public Me Too lawsuit that I was sort of having to deal with daily. And I had just felt like I'd done what I wanted to do in advertising and there wasn't a whole lot more for me to do. So I started to think about what I want to do, where my passion was. And we talked about it in the last episode, but I'm somebody who really loves to be productive. Like, I would have a hard time being retired and do nothing. I like to be busy. I like to make things and I like to build brands. And that's why I got into advertising to begin with. And I had gotten really removed from that. So I decided to leave and I actually started a brand consultancy because it was sort of the easiest way to get out and sort of get back to what my sort of passion was. I was working with startups almost exclusively. And as I mentioned, many of them needed a lot of help in figuring out their brand stories. And so that was really fulfilling because I could come in, work directly with the founders, give them, you know, a roadmap, and then I could see it implemented like the next day because they're startups, they're scrappy, you know? It wasn't like 5 years later, you finally see the campaign hit, which is what it was kind of in the corporate world. So anyway, I was doing that. And then what happened was I actually met James, my co-founder on Mazami through my husband in the summer of 2018. James had been working with Bill and had been creating these hair care formulations on the side. He had his little side hustle that no one knew about. It was, which I found kind of interesting because he was actually working on them for 10 years.
Oh my goodness.
Really
oh my
long goodness. Time to be working on these formulations by himself, basically. He had found a chemist. He just took a long time to do it because he was using a lot of his discretionary income and, you know, his time and his resources to work on this. And he had gotten the products pretty far along, but he really wasn't sure what to do next in terms of, you know, what do you do when you have a product? How do you launch it? You know? So my husband said to him, look, I know nothing about beauty, but Lynn has worked on a lot of beauty, which I have. I've done L'Oreal, I've done Nexxus, I've done Clinique, I've done Vichy, I've done La Roche-Posay, I've done a bunch. So Bill sent him my way. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, I got to meet with this guy and hear his story. And I'm sure it's going to be painful because, I mean, really, he's been working on this for 10 years by himself. How good could it possibly be? I mean, this is my cynical advertising brain speaking. And then I had him over for dinner in New York City with his husband, Masa. And right away, I was like, they just had a spirit and an aura of, I don't know, generosity, empathy. Like, I liked them immediately. They started to tell me the story. We ended up spending all night just talking about why he was doing this and the formulas and everything else. And he gave me the products to try and I thought they were amazing. And then we decided to launch the business together and it's been absolutely fantastic. So it really found me as opposed to me finding it, if you know what I mean.
I love that. So yeah, I think that it's wonderful that someone with the right feeling, with the right vibe, with the right story was enough for you to go, you know what, this is absolutely, alongside obviously the wonderful product, but isn't it interesting how our brains will immediately jump to the cynical when actually, if you give someone a chance and give the story a chance, there's so much opportunity there.
Absolutely. You know, I was glad that I kind of heard him out and that I let it play out, because to your point, had I just said, you know, I don't have time for this, I would have been completely missed out. And the beauty of it is that we were talking last time about partnerships, is that what he needed is what I have and what I do. Mm-hmm. And what he does is what I needed too. In other words, you know, I can't create the product and the formulation. He can. Mm-hmm. He can't create a go-to-market strategy, a brand strategy, a digital strategy, you know, figure out how to do all that. And I can. So that's why I think it was so appealing also, because we knew that we could work together really well to make this thing amazing.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I love hearing the story of how that one kind of fateful meeting followed up by probably a few more conversations, and now a couple of years later and a whole apocalypse, you're still going strong with the business, which is wonderful. I would love to dig a little bit more into something that you were saying when you were talking about your corporate career, because a lot of the listeners may be in that stage where they're trying to decide whether starting a business is right for them, or they're starting a business as a side hustle, they're still having that corporate job. And some of the things that you said there really resonated with me as well. And it's something that we've talked about in this podcast before, where in the corporate world, the higher you go, the less you use your skills, I feel, particularly in creative fields or anything that is related to creativity with strategy side, from my experience that I can speak to, and I'm sure it's relevant in other areas as well, that the more that you kind of climb that career ladder, I mean, I never got to the point of CEO until my own business, but it would be interesting to know what it was that inspired you to leave that role and to start on your own instead.
You know, I just realized that it's almost like the Wizard of Oz, when you peek behind the curtain and there's nothing there, and you get to that job and you realize it's actually a tedious job. It's quite difficult. I'm not having fun, because you only deal with the problems. You know, you don't deal with any of the positives. It's all problems. And I like problem solving. It's not about that, but to do it day in and day out. And it's the type of problems that are not so fun to solve, like lawsuits, as opposed to business problems, which I could solve all day long, right? So it was more about me feeling like, when I looked around the ad industry, me going to do that same job, like if I would have left JWT and went to another agency, I just felt it would be more of the same. And then it's like, okay, so then what are my choices? I could not be the CEO somewhere and take a job where I'm just sort of managing an account, but that would have felt like a step backwards for me in my career. And I've done that. I did that for years. So it just didn't feel like that was going to be different. And then I also felt a little selfish, to be honest, because I felt like, look, I spent all these years building brands for other people. Why can't I do something for myself now? I mean, shit, I'm not getting younger. You know, and it's a little bit of like, put my money where my mouth is too. You know, I've been giving advice to all these other people and all these other brands. What happens if I actually have to take my own advice?
Oh my goodness. The pill that we all have to swallow.
So I kind of felt like, okay, let's just figure that out. And then I can live with that, because then I am living and dying by my own decisions.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work out and the whole thing blows up, yeah, I'll be bummed out, but at least I'll feel like I tried, you know, I did it my way. I didn't have to listen to anyone else.
I love that. I think that I can absolutely resonate with not wanting to listen to other people. I feel like Yeah, I feel like being a business owner can be very freeing, even though it does come with a whole new set of challenges. But I think that's kind of the fun of it, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Yeah, I think that is the fun of it. And I think one of the best parts of being a business owner is that every day is different. And it's the unexpected. You know what you need to do. But there's always things that hopefully are not negative, unexpected things.
Yeah. That's the hope. I'm really curious as well, because you left your corporate career, we'll say, you left your corporate career. You started a service-based business that was within your realm of genius, your expertise, everything else, something that you really enjoyed doing, and rekindled that passion for something that you had done for years and cultivated this experience in. And then you moved into using part of that, but in a product-based business. Did you find any big differences between running a service-based business and running a product-based business that you weren't expecting?
Not really, because, you know, keep in mind when I was in advertising, I'd worked on a lot of brands or products, right? So I've done a lot of launches. And so I just sort of got to see what happens, but just from a slightly different angle, because I was doing, you know, the advertising and marketing. I wasn't doing the product development or dealing with supply chain or dealing with those things. But I saw the clients doing it. So I had kind of that purview into what it takes to launch a brand, which is super helpful, by the way, you know, because I kind of knew the basics. And so there's something for me that was really appealing, though, about having a physical product. Now, I know you're in the service business, too.
Yeah.
And I found that I was getting a little disgruntled with the time that it took to see things happen and seeing something tangible come out of it, because it felt like even though the world is moving really fast, a lot of my clients were not moving fast. And so you would spend a lot of time talking about a strategy and talking about creative and trying to get things out. And then the world would change. And then whatever you were talking about for the last 6 months wasn't relevant anymore. And so you'd have to tweak it. And it just felt unsatisfying to me that it always, you know, it was like, you're always chasing something and you're never really able to pin it down. Whereas when you have a physical product, you're literally like, I made this. Isn't it? Obviously I didn't make my iPhone, but you know what I'm saying? Like you have the thing to show and whatever else happens, like you put that out in the world and there's a moment in time where you can just be really happy about that. I don't know how else to explain it.
No, I think that I understand what you mean. It's as a service-based business owner, there was a lot of thought process. And I'm sure that some of the listeners will be able to agree with this, where you have to kind of reconcile the fact that you're asking people for money for your brain and you're asking people for money for your thoughts. And it's a really weird thing to try and get your head around, that you're like, hey, yeah, I'm going to sell you the way that I think. And then you can take that and see how that fits in with your business, or we'll find a way of us thinking together. And that's what you're selling. And as a designer, I found that the same, because it was digital files mostly that I was supplying. So it wasn't something tangible. Whereas with a product, I can understand how having something physical that you can hand over feels different.
Yeah, I just think it felt to me more like gratifying to have something that I could show for all my work. And, you know, it's one of the things that I realized, like I like renovating houses and doing a lot of the work myself. And I realized it's the same thing. It's like, I like to see the actual floor redone and to be able to look at it and see the results and to be able to point to it. Whereas like what you're saying in the service business, they're buying your thinking, but sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
You think they're buying your thinking and you give them your thinking, but then all of a sudden you see what they're doing with it and it's not your thinking.
You're selling your thinking, but you don't know if they're buying.
Correct. Or they're buying part of it and it's not the part that you wanted them to buy, you know? So that's the other, it's like you just don't always have control over the end product, because they're getting your advice and counsel and they're taking what they will, but it's not always exactly the way you would do it. And it, you know, I mean, the amount of times that I, you know, clients redoing creative and, you know, you'd be cringing inside And you'd have these conversations with them about why that was a bad decision and why they shouldn't do that. And they didn't care and they wanted to do it their way. And there's nothing you can do. They're the client. That's the thing. Like at the end of the day, they're paying the bills. It's their business. If they want to do it that way, despite all the counsel against it, you're going to lose that battle. They're going to do it the way they want. So that's happened a fair amount of times. I mean, the good clients are the ones that will go, oh, okay, yeah, that's a good point. You know, we won't change that. But it's almost impossible, I find, for clients not to change things.
Yeah. But where with your product-based business, you found that it kind of, it filled that niche where you could bring the experience that you had, because I guess, and I'd be curious to know your insights in this. From your perspective, did you feel like you needed to bring anything extra that you hadn't brought before? Because I guess the role that you took within that business was still an extension of what you had been doing in your brand consultancy and within your advertising career. So it wasn't because your business partner had been the one developing the formulas and doing the product focus side. It's kind of taking your brand consultancy background and all that strategy and thinking and everything else and just applying it to this new business. Is that right?
Yeah. And that was kind of fun because it's sort of like I could either be my best client or worst client, right?
Yes.
You know, and kind of like, I have to sort of eat my own dog food, if you know what I mean. Like I had to take all the stuff that I've been telling other people and apply it to myself.
Yeah.
And that can be scary. But you know what? I've been doing it so long that I found that it was really easy for me to make the decisions I wanted to make. And it's also like these days, nothing is really set in stone.
True.
Even physical products, you know, you can change the packaging, you can update the labels, you could change the graphics, like nothing is ever forever, really. So that's the other thing. I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs get sidetracked because they're paralyzed by wanting it to be perfect. And I think if it's 80% great, like it's better to get it out there and iterate than spend months, you know, fine tuning until the point where, you know, you think it's perfect. Because by the time it's perfect, I'm guaranteed something will change anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. I think the whole, well, it used to say progress over perfection, but now I say personality over perfection. Like people are going to refer to you and they're going to connect with you, even if you're still working out the kinks.
Yeah, definitely.
So when it comes to the way that your business has grown and developed, and I'm aware this is a partnership, but from your experience, are there any particular hardships or successes, kind of just those pivotal moments that you weren't expecting that have either kind of spurred you on or inspired you to learn something different within your business?
Well, COVID, certainly I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, that's a big one.
But what I've realized is as much as you can put together your plans and try to control what you do and have your launch plan all set up, you know, and I am a bit type A in that sense. I want things to be kind of planned out. You have to just go with the flow at times. You know, you just can't expect it to all go your way. So that's been a little bit of a learning curve for me because it's hard, you know, it's hard to pivot and to, you know, have to think about doing things differently than what you had in your head. But I think that's a reality of business these days, unfortunately. So, you know, whether it's COVID or, you know, like we were talking about before, a hurricane or other things that happen, I think it's probably a healthy thing to learn the skill to be able to pivot and move on and not think back.
Yeah, I think that that's a really fair point. And it's one that I think is often overlooked, that adaptability and flexibility within business is so key. And I think that living in this world where it's instant gratification, where everything is now, 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 it can be really hard to have that patience. And I speak from my own experience because I am not a patient person and it's something that I'm trying to practice. Because things do take time, like both great things and awful things and everything in between. We learn by adapting what we're doing to suit the circumstances that we find ourselves in, because you can't always control everything around you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting. So we've talked a lot around your business and where the foundations were and kind of how your role has evolved within your business. But I'd love to talk a little bit around the branding side. This is the bit that I absolutely adore. And as a fellow brand strategist, I'm really keen to hear your insights into this. So let's start with your business name. How was it that you chose your business name? I think you've already alluded to it slightly, but yeah. What's the story behind it?
So when James and I decided to go into business together, he had a different name and it just didn't make sense to me. It didn't have a reason for being. So the good thing about being flexible and open-minded is that James agreed to move on from that name that he'd been living with for 10 years and look for something else. And so when we started our exploratory, you know, for me, it's got to, as you would probably say the same thing, right? It's got to be part of the story and align with your values and your vision and your mission and all that. So it's got to reflect very simply who you are. Our whole thing was sort of an East meets West philosophy. We have this Japanese ocean botanical, and it was actually Masa is James's husband. And, you know, it sort of struck us that he really has been the muse behind the brand the whole time, because he's the one that introduced James to the ingredient. He's always been sort of the Zen voice of reason, which we love. He also runs our Masami Institute now, which is we give back to fund ocean research. And so we decided to name the brand after him, but we were playing around with different versions of Masa. And when we landed on Masami, the thing that was like serendipity, sometimes you have those like tingles that happen, we realized that it means truly beautiful in Japanese.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, oh my God, this is it. And then, of course, we were like, the trademark's available, because that's always the next thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I found something wonderful. Can I actually have it? Or has someone already found this?
Yes. So that was how we did it. And then from there, everything else kind of fell in place. The brand is gender neutral. I think our packaging reflects that. We have, like I said, this very East meets West simplicity, sensibility, very Zen. Our packaging is quite simple as well. You know, we're very much natural seaweed, no sulfates, no parabens, no phthalates. So the color also reflects, I think, that tie to nature. So there are a lot of brand cues that we sort of built in that reflected our values.
Amazing. And when it came to defining I'm assuming that you were heavily involved in, if not the only person doing the brand strategy to start with, but when it comes to the visual identity and everything that you were saying there, that kind of was reflections of your values and your strategy, was that something that you invested in straight away? Was that something that you took some time over? And or was it something that you did internally? Because I'm not fully aware of your kind of skill set and background. So,
oh no, I can't do design work. I wish I could. So what we did is we spent some time on the brand positioning and defining the brand positioning and the values. And then from there, we ended up hiring a really great package designer. And it was the one thing that I wanted to spend the most money on, because I feel like that is, for a lot of people, the shortcut, you know, the telegraphed brand is like your packaging. So we invested there. We hired a designer named Joe Doucette, who won the Smithsonian Award, I think it was 2 years ago. Really amazing designer. And he did, I think, 5 designs for us. And we chose this one, which just felt like a no-brainer. And I think we're just very lucky, because he's really understood what we were trying to do. Because I really do think your packaging can make or break a brand.
I think for a product-based business, well, no, I guess for service-based as well in a certain way, although packages are slightly different. But for a product-based business, particularly if you have a specific target market in mind and a target price point, and like you were saying, the positioning piece is going to be so key to get that nailed first. Because if it's misaligned with the way your ideal customer perceives that packaging and it doesn't line up, you're never going to be able to get the return and that take that space in the market that you're looking to fill.
Yeah.
So I am curious, you talked about the designer. You said that it was a packaging designer that you that you hired. Is that correct? So yeah. It wasn't like a brand identity designer, but did he develop your brand identity as part of the packaging process, or was it the packaging was the key and then the brand identity kind of flowed from there?
It was a little bit of both. He did packaging with some brand identity cues. And then what we ended up doing is taking what he did and we brought in another designer to flesh out what we call the brand guidelines. That worked pretty well for us because, you know, he doesn't do things like, okay, how does the brand look in social? You know, what type of photography, like get into the nitty gritty. Mm-hmm. But we wanted that. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So you had kind of this packaging designer that helped you develop the packaging that reflected the brand positioning work that you had done. And then you had another designer that kind of took that and flowed it through all of your kind of your marketing strategy and your marketing platforms. Perfect. So your business has only been up and running for how long is it? Is it nearly 2 years now?
We launched in February 2020. So we spent a year and a half before that doing everything, but we haven't, you know, we started selling product just last year.
Okay, cool. Because the reason that I ask is, we talked about this, I think it was in this episode or it might have been the previous one, where your initial marketing strategy and plans were kind of thrown to the wayside because of the way that COVID hit. So when it came to marketing your business, not only did your business have to change, I guess, to some degree because of supplier issues and everything else, but when it comes to marketing, I guess the question is, how did you find marketing your business when no one was leaving their homes? So having to do a product launch with a purely online marketing strategy.
Well, I mean, the good thing is we were planning to be a heavy DTC oriented brand anyway, direct to consumer. So we're what I call DTC plus. So we have our own website. We're also on Amazon. We're actually on Amazon in the US, the UK, Canada, Singapore. And then we are also on a number of other e-commerce sites like Verishop. And then we're in a few brick and mortar and salons. Now, originally that was a much bigger part of my plan, which obviously had to sort of go by the wayside because the salons were closing, literally. So we just really focused in on our digital business and our content. And we ended up spending a lot of time doing things like blog posts, podcasts. I started doing quite a few podcasts, which I really enjoy for a lot of reasons, but I think great way to get the story and also be able to, you know, they're evergreen, you know, somebody, it's like, if somebody likes a podcast, which, you know, if I stumble on one I like, I'll listen to a lot of the past episodes. So I think it's great. So we started doing a lot more content creation, a lot of social, and that really became a lot of our focus at launch instead of, to your point, like we don't have the benefit of being in stores where people can really touch and see and smell our products. So we had to kind of create that experience online as best we can. Now, the good thing is we were able to get into salons in June. We're in all Spoke and Wheel salons in the US, and we're also in Dream Dry. And that's great because, you know, we're not just sold at the salon, but they use us as a back bar product. And that's like when people really get to experience our product. So that's why it's so important. But it's still slow, you know, things are still not fully open, and salons, there's some that are not going to open, and a lot of them are still at limited capacity. So we just have to kind of be patient, I guess, as things open.
I am curious, and this is a bit of a off the wall question, I guess. Knowing what you know now, if COVID hadn't have happened, but knowing how you have launched your product and you've done your marketing now where it's much more online focused, would you change the way that you had planned to do your marketing originally?
Oh, absolutely. Because we would have definitely focused more on the sampling and experiential side, for sure. And I mean, the good thing about people being at home was that self-care became a real topic.
Yeah, it did.
And also clean beauty, you know, the fact that our products are clean and don't have toxins, people, even though clean beauty was sort of a trending topic before, I think it really picked up steam during COVID. I think people are just more aware of the food they're eating, what they're putting on their bodies, what they're, you know, just what cleaning products they're using in their house. Like, I think people are just trying to avoid as many of those toxic ingredients as possible, which for us was also a good thing because we're on trend, you know. So we hit both the self-care angle because we're luxurious and high performing and salon quality, but we're also clean. So I think that actually helped us.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of before, because there were so many stories around the environmental impacts of not having humans out and about in the world that I wonder if that really did help to spearhead the environmental awareness that I tended to see a lot of people becoming aware of, that, like you were saying, the products they use, the chemicals they use, and the beauty products that they were choosing. So that's really interesting that from something that locked so many people down, it really did help to kind of channel this new eco awareness, I guess, and your product line just, I hit at the ideal time. So a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. It was sort of like, well, we can't really do what we wanted in terms of reaching people, but we at least feel like we have some tailwinds. Obviously, no one wants COVID to happen, but, you know, for us, it wasn't the worst thing from a business perspective because of what we just talked about. So,
yeah, amazing. So one question that I do like to ask when it comes to marketing that is always insightful for our listeners, and I'd love to hear kind of not only from your experience as a business owner now, but just from all of your wonderful background and expertise in advertising. But what have you found to be the most effective or your favorite, either one is fine, method of marketing for small businesses or independent businesses?
I would say one thing that we did, which we sort of stumbled on last year, which has been incredibly effective for us, has been partnerships. We have created partnerships with other like-minded brands, whether they're female-founded brands or clean beauty brands or skincare brands, whatever, or luxury brands. And that has been amazing because we have done a bunch of things, you know, giveaways, gift with purchases, blog posts, live streams, and we've been able to kind of lift each other up. So we've been able to, you know, increase our followers, increase our subscribers, you know, and it's a similar customer base if you find the right brands to connect with. Obviously, you know, you can't expect, you know, to take a brand that's like, you know, a cheap value brand and connect it with our brand and have those customers come along for the ride. But that has been amazing, actually. And it also doesn't cost anything. That's the other thing. You know, it costs product, basically, if you're going to do a giveaway or something, but very, very efficient way to drive your business.
I think that it's a really wonderful way of utilizing other markets as well. And again, it harks back to a lot of the things that we were talking about in the previous episode of finding someone that aligns with your values and your intention, your purpose and your motivation, because then you have this opportunity to collaborate and kind of join forces so that your joint audiences are able to experience the product and both brands as well in their natural habitat, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like, I feel like our attitude, you know, it's interesting. My attitude has always been like, why not partner together if we can help each other? But I had approached a few brands pre-COVID and I didn't get a great response. It was sort of like, I don't really see the point. And then in COVID, I think there was a more of a spirit of generosity where brands were trying to do things because they had to. But I think what's happened is a lot of these smaller brands have realized that it's actually really great and that you don't need to compete with each other and that you can lift each other up, and doing shout outs for other brands does not actually hurt your brand.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a huge fan of collaboration. I feel like as long as it's mutually benefit, if your audiences align and you're wanting the same thing, why wouldn't you want to support each other?
Exactly. So that has been like a silver lining for us, because I think we found some really great partners and some of them we continue to work with. And that's been also just helpful for me as a founder to have other founders to connect with, you know, to compare notes and to say like, hey, you know, are you seeing this happen, or is Facebook really not effective for you either? And they're like, no, it's not working for us either. Okay, great. It's not just us, you know, yeah. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think collaborations have far more benefits than people tend to realize. They tend to see the surface level, which is what's the benefit from a sales perspective, when actually it can go, that connection and that collaboration and being in it together can really go a lot deeper.
Yeah. For sure.
So from everything that you have very kindly shared with us today, from your business journey so far, If there was one key piece of advice that you'd want to share with the listeners who are maybe in the early stages or the first couple of years of their business, what kind of advice would you like to impart?
I would say one of the most valuable things you can do is build a network, and think about a network not just as sort of people in your current community, but finding people that are a bit of outsiders too, who can give you just different perspectives on things. And you can start building this network while you're in a job, if you're still thinking about like, okay, I want to launch this business, but I'm not ready. Because I will tell you that having a network of advisors, mentors, peers, friends, just people to bounce things off of is invaluable. Absolutely invaluable. It's one of the best things you can do.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that that's fantastic advice. And yeah, go forth and find your network, guys, because it will really help you to grow and flourish and learn a lot about yourself alongside learning about others.
Exactly.
Brilliant. So thank you so, so much for joining me today, Lynn. Where can the listeners find more about you and your brand?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm also at Lynn Powered on any social channel. Masami is lovemasami.com, LoveMasami.com. We're also, as I mentioned, on Amazon in US, Canada, UK, Singapore, and our social handle is Love Masami Hair, pretty much everywhere.
Brilliant. I will pop all of those links into the show notes so anyone listening can go and find them, or like you said, go and have a little search on Amazon, try out the products for yourselves. Thank you so much. It's just been really insightful to hear how a different type of business, because I feel like I speak to a lot of service-based businesses, and it's been really, really interesting to have a peek behind the scenes of a product-based business and particularly a partnership as well. So thank you for sharing so openly and honestly with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Amazing. And listeners, if you want to find more, head over to the show notes. In the meantime, I would love to ask you to go and nip over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, because it really does help the podcast to grow and means that I can continue bringing you all of these new episodes and new guests every week. And until next time, head over to our community on Instagram or Facebook with the links in the show notes, and we can continue these conversations in the Brand Lounge.